Today we welcome Wilkes Starkus to the podcast, Australian young adult fiction writer best known for his novels The Sidekicks and The First Third. The Sidekicks was long listed for the Gold Inky Award and winner of the Ibby Australian Ina Noel Award for a young emerging writer.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today, Will. Can I say I absolutely love The Sidekicks, the voices, the storyline, the humour. It was a really beautiful read.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Now, The Sidekicks is a beautiful young adult novel about losing someone young and navigating the world without them. And I read that the story was actually inspired by one of your best friends, Ben, who you lost too early. Was this both a cathartic and painful experience for you to remember his life and preserve some of your memories of him?
I always intended to eventually mine that experience as a novel, but I always told myself I wasn't good enough to write it. Mm-hmm. No matter what praise or accolades I got from my previous books, I was like, no, I'm not good enough. And then I remember visiting his house to visit his mum a couple of years ago, and I saw his photo on the fridge and I realized, oh, wait, I'd started to forget what he looked like. Mm-hmm. And I was like, right, okay, I need to go back. I need to write this now. Wise can still remember all that stuff. So I did, and it was definitely cathartic. It was definitely the most difficult book I had to write, and, you know, mining those experiences, I definitely don't want to write something as intensely personal as that for a short while, so I forget how harrowing it was. But to have it on the page and to have people who've experienced something similar tell me it spoke to them really means a lot.
I'm sure we've all lost someone in our lives and it really did speak to us, especially the way people dealt with their grief and people dealt with it differently. And Ryan says, I just need to dive back in. I need to train myself to feel fine with this. And did you find that there were different ways of dealing with this grief and different people did it in different ways?
Definitely. And I went back to all the people in my life who experienced this death and I spoke to them and I started to notice that there was no one set way to grieve. And I don't even want to say that the different ways I show in this book are the only ways that you grieve, but I wanted to really focus on the ways three or four people really, really grieve and go from there.
I love the honest account when Ryan meets Mr. Collins and says, we all pretend we know how to fix what you're feeling, but we don't. And it shows that adults are just as clueless about how to deal with these really big losses as kids are.
It's good that you mentioned Mr. Collins, because that was actually when I was first writing the book. I was very wary that I wasn't any of the three male protagonists. And so Mr. Collins is kind of like my surrogate. He gets in there early. He says everything I'd sort of say.
Okay.
And then he sort of steps back again and you see the boys take center stage and they have to grieve in their own ways.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And I thought it was just such honest advice. And sometimes we don't know either. And it was good that they were all in this together and all navigating it together.
And that's the thing. I really wanted to show what that immediate moment after someone dies, sort of how that feels and how they eventually pull themselves out of it. Because if you ever find my first book, usually you'll find it in a St. Vinny's somewhere or a secondhand bookshop. It's called Loathing Lola, and I wrote it when I was 17. And you can tell a 17-year-old boy wrote it because I was very hesitant to show myself on the page. And, you know, when you're talking to someone, you can tell they're talking to you, like, through a veil and they're being very careful about what they say and what they imply. This is basically the book version of that. One of the things that it does is that, because I got the book deal because Ben died and I wrote a chapter based on his funeral. And that was the chapter that Pam McMillan ended up purchasing and wanting a book made out of. But I kind of cheated because chapter two, it kind of goes 3 months later and then flashes forward. And I never showed the reality of those 3 months and how you pull yourself out of that funk. And so with The Sidekicks, I really wanted to make sure I dove in deep and I didn't escape with a flash forward and really, really show. I don't show where they end up, but I show how the boys start to find their feet again and you see the beginnings of them healing. I definitely wanted to show their immediate reaction to that moment and So, you know, Ryan starts off right in that moment of he's just heard that someone's died, and then the story starts immediately after that disclosure. But when you come to Harley, his story starts the day before, and then you come to Miles, and he starts the morning before. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to show a little bit more context for each of them, and that change, that recasts the way their stories are told. But also, I also wanted to sort of skip ahead and make sure that their stories extended further than the previous ones, so it didn't feel like it was just recycling the same plot points. I wanted to see sort of Ryan's journey continuing in the two others. I wanted to see Harley evolve further in Miles' section. And I wanted Miles to sort of have to eventually tie together not only his arc, but the arc of the three boys coming together.
Yeah, I think each of the voices were done so beautifully. They're authentic and distinctive, and I just loved each of them. I think you're right in saying that it wasn't repetitive at all. It just continued a story, but in their own way. I actually really loved Harley and his dry, cynical humour. He kind of says things that everyone's thinking, you know, oh, it hasn't really been the year of Harley. And even at the funeral, when they say, oh, this is just what he would have wanted, he goes, yeah, a funeral, definitely what he wanted. And you just heard this beautiful teenage voice, but with this sort of sadness and humour. Where did you channel Harley's voice?
Because that was the biggest obstacle for me when I was writing it, because I knew I wanted to write three distinct voices, but the first and second drafts, they weren't particularly distinct. They all sounded like me. And I really, really wanted to make sure I got these voices right. And Miles sort of started to come into his own. But Harley, I found really, really difficult. And it wasn't until, you know, I sat down with my editor and she was like, look, I don't think this is working. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think it's working either. And what I did was the week before, you know, the book was due, I scrapped Harley's section entirely and I rewrote it from scratch. And I really wanted to make sure, because he was starting to sound a lot like Ryan. Mm-hmm. And Ryan, you know, his mother is the head of English. He is someone who he's more lyrical in his prose. You know, there are the extended motifs, you know, running through. There are things there that, you know, you could write an essay about the things that he says and the way he constructs his phrases. And there's something really poetic about his section. The problem was we were then going to, you know, the rougher kid who had escaped back home. He's the rebel without a cause, but he had the same lyrical prose. Mm-hmm. And that might have been great for me as an author, because I could say, hey, look at all these fancy sentences I can write. But it wasn't doing Harley. Wasn't doing right by Harley at all. So I sat back and I thought, okay, who is he? And I just wrote it how he would have spoken it, and really tried to make sure that it was as colloquial as possible. It pained me a lot, but I put the should ofs instead of the should haves. And, those little things that helped it feel really authentic, that, you know, he's still intelligent, but he's intelligent in a very different way. And the whole point of the book is perspectives, and that we judge people because of the little things that they do. Like Miles judges Harley because of the fact that he says should've. But you look at, you know, the way Harley constructs his story, and he can be just as eloquent as the others, but it's his own special brand of eloquence.
Ryan and Miles, they were very distinctive, but Harley in the middle just had this beautiful, distinctive voice that I really liked about him, and I loved his sort of dry cynicism. It was nice. As you say in one of your interviews, when you lose someone, you not only lose them, you lose the life you've built around them, and not only that, the future you've planned, and like Ryan, the secrets you've entrusted to them. He says, he was the only person who knew, the only person I told, and it made me think that the people in our lives are so much more than we ever realise, and I think this was really well captured in the novel.
Thanks. Did you want me to expand on that? Oh,
yeah,
I'll just sit
sure.
here listening to compliments the whole time.
I can just sit here and do that if you like, but it might be boring for others.
yeah, well, that's exactly what I wanted to capture, and I'm glad that comes through, because while the novel isn't my experience, it is, you know, I've used those boys to show what I have learnt through this experience, so that, you know, if someone else ever goes through it or knows someone that's going through something similar, they can see experiences reflected back at them, but a way through that.
one of your fans on Twitter, at Jeremy Spence, I promised him I'd ask you questions about Ryan because he loved Ryan. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you lots of questions about Ryan now. This is your space, Jeremy Spence. The challenges Ryan experienced in his relationship with Todd, it really felt authentic, and we almost feel his fear when he pulls away abruptly when they're in public because he hasn't told anyone about his relationship with Todd yet and Isaac's gone. And I love how he says, I don't want them to look at me and see a rainbow, but is it better that they look at me and see a lie? Do you think that perceptions of people who are in these relationships, do you think the perception of society is still that narrow that they pigeonhole people like that?
That's a really funny thing, is because Ryan's arc was based on, you know, my own fears. If you just substitute swimmer for writer, you know, it was me fearing that coming out would change the way people looked at me as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And a casual, you know, Google search of me shows that those fears were kind of founded. When I came out in the days before the Sidekicks was released, you know, you had schools cancelling bookings, adjusting which year levels I could speak to, because I wasn't now just the young writer or the young Greek writer. I was the young gay Greek writer.
Wow.
And, you know, they had no problems with the other parts of my sort of the parts that make me. But, you know, once you get to the gay facet of the identity, suddenly that changed the way that people viewed my work and viewed me. And so it was definitely scary. And this book was about me working through that anxiety. And I was, as I was writing the book, I was coming out to the people around me. And so the act of writing Ryan's journey creatively, it helped me sort of push through that. So, you know, I'd just come out to my mum just before I started writing.
Wow.
But, you know, I'd come out to my friends, but no one else really. And so I became more confident in myself as I wrote Ryan's section. But the main thing that I'd learnt was that, you know, it's more important to be seen than to fear that others will see you differently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yes, people see me differently now, but for every one or two schools that, say, cancelled a booking, I had five or six or seven come out and, you know, say they wanted to have me and that they had gay straight alliances that they wanted me to speak at. They had, I spoke at a school just last week that had a space that was a queer space. It was basically a small kitchenette that these kids had taken over, and it was called The Closet.
Okay.
And they wanted me to come and speak to the kids there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. As scary as it was to be seen as a gay author, I don't think my work has had the effect that it had until I came out, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So coming out as a gay author, it helped me do things that I couldn't do closeted and that I couldn't do when I wasn't writing about this stuff, or when I was at least gently implying it but never owning it completely. And so that's really what I learned while I was writing Ryan. And when my worst fears were realized in that first week of release, and I thought, oh, wow, I spent, you know, 8 years touring Australia, speaking at schools, but all of that experience was turned to dust overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to rebuild myself again. And I was carrying everything I'd learned from writing Ryan. Look, I'm better because of it. It's a shame that it didn't go as smoothly, but I'm certain it's getting better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certain, you know, whatever I went through, the next author won't have to. It won't be as bad. Mm-hmm. And the author after that, it won't be as bad. And, you know, the teenager who's reading it will certainly not be as bad for them. That's the hope. And if it's something I have to go through so that others don't, then I am all for it.
It's just bizarre that it even matters.
It was a really fascinating thing because they were like, oh, you can't launch the book here. But they'd invited me to speak about the site, the first third previously that featured a gay character. Yeah. And it was a whole load of contradictions because, well, there's this fear that if we talk about sexuality, then it's somehow, you know, a how-to guide. It's simply just this is someone else's human experience. And the one thing, I was invited to speak to a cohort of year 10s that had read the first third. And it's always my go-to example for this, because as I was going in to talk about the first third, it was a Q&A. So these girls, they'd never read a book by an author that was alive. Right. So they, at least for school. And so it was a really great experience for them to sort of pick it apart with me, and we could talk about it, talk about what we liked, what we didn't, talk about process, compare their readings to my intentions and going from there. So it was a really great opportunity for them. But as I was walking in, you know, the teacher was like, oh, by the way, don't mention the gay character. And I thought that was really fascinating, because we would never expect that of, say, like Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know all that dubious sexual humor? Yeah, don't mention that in front of the kids. Like, come on. And that's all, it's half of what Shakespeare is.
And you know what's anyway. Funny about it? No one cares about the violence. You know, you read Macbeth and everyone's killing everybody, including suicide, and that's fine, but don't talk about a gay character. Like, what's that about?
You know, and these are the same schools that have Jasper Jones on the year 7 and 8 reading list, and that... But that's another conversation to have for another time. And so I went in there, I was talking, and, you know, by the end of the session, I was like, okay, so who was your favorite character? I expected them to say the Greek grandmother, because that's what everyone always says. And this girl puts up her hand and goes, oh, I really love Styx, who's the gay character. Mm. And I'm like, oh, no. And so I try to pivot away from that. And I'm like, anyone else have anything to say? And no one else really did. I'm like, all right, so what was your favorite scene? So I just tried to change the subject.
Yeah.
And that same girl put up a hand. I'm like, oh, really? And I'm like, yes, what is it? She's like, I really like the scene where he talked about having sex with a boy. And I'm like, this is it. Like, the teachers have, like, sunken into their seats. And I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely never coming back to this school. But I was really curious, because he was a girl who I assumed was heterosexual in year 10. Why on earth did a boy talking about losing his virginity to another boy, why did that speak to her? And I asked her, oh, what was it about the scene that drew you to it? And she goes, oh, it just helped me understand my best friend Sam a little bit better.
Oh, wow.
And it was in that instance that I realized, you know, it's not that there's that we fear this sort of, oh, kids are going to read it and suddenly realize they're gay. Like, that's that may happen, and that's great. It saves them half a lifetime of questioning themselves.
Yeah.
But the big thing was, it's just showing people others in their world, mm-hmm. showing, you know, other people's place, showing how you should, you know, react to them with kindness and compassion, and showing you a little bit about what they go through. And it's shining a light on other experiences.
And just respecting people, you know.
It's the same reason why we read The Happiest Refugee, the mm-hmm. same reason why we read historical fiction, so that we better understand the world in which we live. And, you know, I'm really glad to see that the taboo around books that deal with sexuality is dwindling.
Mm-hmm.
It's diminishing at too slow a pace. And for every time we hesitate about a text, you know, that's we're failing our students. Because let's face it, for me to publish a book, and look, my books are written, you know, while I'm writing to entertain teenagers, I am, you know, a darling of the New South Wales English syllabus. Mm-hmm. I went through to, or at least I see myself as a darling. I went through, you know, all the way up to Extension 2. It was my favorite subject. I lived and breathed English at school. Ask all my teachers. They probably still hate me for it. But it was – English is something that I'm passionate about, especially high school English. And these books, for them to be written with education markets in mind, they're carefully vetted. We have sensitivity readers. We have industry professionals, whether they be publishing and also – heads of English around the country reading them to say, hey, this is appropriate for schools. Okay, maybe this isn't. You know, we do all those checks and balances on the publishing side of things. And then to have, say, me coming out and that instantly tarnishing the book without anyone reading it is really disheartening, because we're supposed to teach critical thinking and teach, you know, reading texts and understanding them. And yet sometimes... we're so afraid of, you know, the synopsis that we don't look deeper into a text.
Absolutely. It's been the same. I've spoken to a number of authors about the idea of suicide as well, and you mentioned Jasper Jones, and there is this fear of talking about it as if it's going to promote it. But kids need to unpack these things. They need to talk about them. You know, they can't keep them locked in their head. That's the whole problem.
Yeah. And it's you. And if you have that conversation in a guided setting, in a classroom where you're prepared for it, where, you know, you have the resources and you have, you know, you can send them off to other people to continue that conversation if they need that extra guidance, that's that's what an education is.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's, you know.
And it's the whole child, you know. It's developing the whole child. It's funny you talk about English. I'm an English head teacher myself, and I'm loving what I'm hearing from you here. But I shared my review of your novel on the English Teachers Association Facebook page, and so many teachers commented on the fact that your portrayal of a teacher was so authentically written, and they all wanted to know if your mother really is a head teacher English.
No. My mum has read 3 books in her life, and I wrote them all.
Oh, so I hope they're yours.
No, she's also read 50 Shades of Grey, let's be fair. But the reason why it's so authentic is that, you know, at school I was in the English staff room, you know, and now when I do school visits, I wrote half of the sidekicks sitting in English staff rooms. Like, this was between classes that I was speaking to, I was writing this book. And so, you know, some of my closest friends are English teachers. That obviously affects it. And if I wasn't an author, you could bet everything that you own that I would be an English teacher by now. It's something that's, you know, English teachers are my people. And that was it. This allowed me to sort of write about that.
Well, it was scarily authentic. I thought you might have been spying on my own staff room. So well done.
That's the thing. We all think we're really unique and special. But if there's one thing Turing has taught me, is that we are all exactly the same.
Going back to Styx, I've got to say, I loved Styx. He was actually my favourite character as well. I love the friendship between Bill and Lucas, or Styx, whoever you want to call him. And secondly, I love the portrayal of a young adult with cerebral palsy, because it made me think there are not many characters in literature who have cerebral palsy. And I think it's important to depict all kinds of people in literature. And it really broke me when, you know, he was at the pub and he met that guy, Dean, and it says, Dean slid the coaster off the table and scrunched it into a ball. It broke my heart a little bit.
Yeah.
What was your intention, or how did you come up with the character of Styx and his condition?
So the whole thing with me is that I obviously draw from my life, fictionalize it in parts. And, you know, while the first third is very much a love letter to my family in its in all the forms that takes, whether it be the family that you have, the family that you're born with, the family that you build yourself, the family you seek out. I also wanted to reflect on the parts of my life that, you know, are a bit disappointing, whether others have disappointed me, hi dad, or if I wanted to sort of look at the times where I've disappointed myself. And one of the things that sort of struck me, because, and the reason this sounds like I was just throwing everything at a wall to see what stuck, and the truth is, because I was, you know, my first book did not sell very well. This was my second chance, and I thought this was going to be my last book. So I thought, okay, I want to hit as many points as I can, as authentically as I can. And one of the big things I wanted to deal with was, you know, university, my mates all went to the same uni. It was great. We thought we'd see each other every day. But the problem is, you go to uni and you realize you don't take the same subjects, so your timetables don't line up and you never see each other. And I realized I felt our friendship circle start to dissipate. So I was like, okay, everyone, let's all organize to have a lunch, and we'll each bring one person we've met at, you know, uni, so we can expand our friendship circle. So, you know, we all organized it, and me being myself, I was 10 minutes late. I rush in and I'm sitting opposite this guy called Chris. And I always say, to make friends, in adulthood, or at least young adulthood, you have to like the same movies and hate the same people. And Chris and I were completely in sync, rattling off references, laughing about the same stuff, making fun of the same stuff, and it was perfect. And at the end of the lunch, he's like, oh, Will, can you move your feet? They're on my stuff. And I'm like, oh, what? And I look down and I realize my feet are resting on a set of crutches. And I thought, oh, sorry. And he gets up and I'm like, oh, how did you injure yourself? And he doesn't say anything. And then as he walks to the door, I realize he's not injured, but he has cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. And the first thought that runs through my head is, lucky I'm not friends with him. That would be really inconvenient. And, you know, when you have one of those first thoughts and then you hear yourself having it and you're deeply ashamed of yourself, that was it. So I was, you know, a straight A student. I went to a fancy private school in Sydney. And yet the first time I encountered someone with a disability, that was my first thought. And had I listened to that first thought, I would have lost one of the best friends that I have, and one of the closest friendships that I've built since then. I would not have had that because of that, you know, that learned prejudice. And so I ran after him. I made sure we became friends. And I'm really glad that we did that. But I'm constantly reminded of that first thought. The difference between me wanting to hang out with him was him sitting down and standing up. And that's horrible. And I wanted to write about that. And, you know, not only because going around speaking about the book, I have to mention the anecdote that inspired it. So that, you trust me, you tell a room full of 200 kids that story and they look at you with the judgiest eyes. And trust me, that will keep me from ever having that first thought ever again. But also the hope is that if they pick up the book without knowing the context and not knowing my history, they won't have that same first thought themselves.
And I love your honesty, you know, to be able to just be honest about that and show that we all make mistakes, we're all ashamed of ourselves, but it's what you do after is what's important.
And, you know, every big lesson that I've learned, be it a character moment or, you know, just at school, it came from a mistake. And we need to, you know, one, we need to accept that we're human and we do make mistakes. But two, we need to expect that of the people around us as well, that they need to make mistakes, but also expect that they'll grow from them.
And that forgiveness. And I guess you were saying that you came out to your mum just before the book's release, and I loved Bill's mum and I love her reaction. It said, "Mum reacted to it as I expected. She denied it, grieved it, got over it, and then vowed to kill anyone who wronged him." I thought that was such a mum thing to do.
Yeah. Got to go through, you know, the WOG stages of grieving.
I like that.
Always ends with threatening to kill someone.
I think it's a very motherly instinct too. I think that's quite universal. Anyone who wrongs my boy or girl, that's it. I really liked the beautiful sort of philosophical ideas in your novel. I mean, the sidekicks, it was the idea of the rubber band and people snapping back together and filling a pool together. And in the first third, it's the idea that in order to keep family together, someone has to be the glue. And of course, the idea that the first third of his life is over and the second third is the beginning. Do you form these ideas as a central part of your writing? Is that your writing process, or do they come somewhere along the line later on?
It depends. So that idea of the first third, that was really, really there, you know, to begin with. Whereas the rubber bands, because I knew I was writing a book about characters and human relationships, but I didn't really have a central image yet. And I visited my old drama teacher. She was teaching at a new school, and I was going to sort of surprise the kids who she was directing in their school play. And she was directing them, and one of them kept turning his back to his onstage wife. And my drama teacher got up and she explained this idea of, you know, staging. When you're on stage and you share a connection with someone, you have to imagine as if there's a rubber band between you, and that keeps your body language in check to make sure you're always facing each other. And that, I had a flashback to when she told us that same thing in year eight. And I thought, wow, that is a really perfect metaphor for life. And that we're constantly going through it, tying rubber bands around people. And not only that, but we feel their pull throughout our life to different intensities. But, you know, the people that we collect in our lives shape the way that we live it.
Yeah, it was a beautiful sentiment, and it made a lot of sense, because when you think about your own life, you know, why you're drawn to particular people, or why you keep going back, you know, to your childhood friends, etc., it is definitely that idea. It's a great metaphor. And I hear today on Twitter you're recognised on the train, so you're, like, really famous now.
So I'm on the train, and we're going to a concert, and I'm like, great, this is going to be good. And someone comes up to me, so she's just left a group of about six girls, and she's got a phone in her hand. She's like, excuse me. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I thought she just wanted me to take a photo of her with her friends. So I'm like, oh, would you like a photo? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, cool, I'll head over. She's like, no, I'd like a photo with you. And I'm like, what? And she's like, oh, do you remember when you visited blank school and you taught the year 12's creative writing? And I'm like, yes. She's like, oh, we were in that class. And they all started screaming at me and waving. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, this has happened. This is the strange thing.
That's awesome. I enjoyed that tweet. So what's next for you? You said you didn't want to write anything as heavy as you've just written, because you've just come out of this book, which was loved. But what's next for you? What's going on with you now?
So I've just finished my next book. We're just looking for a home for it now. And it's a fantasy novel, so it's something a little different from me. I just wanted to sort of have a palate cleanser, just have a lot more fun, just really, you know, write a book that – you know, if I was a kid, you know, I would love the sidekicks in the first third, but I'd also want to pick up something that was really energetic and just, you know, balls to the wall adventure. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to marry the tone of the sidekicks in the first third in an adventure style story, just to prove that I could write something a little different and to just take a break. Because, you know, when you look at the first third and the sidekicks, they are, what if my grandmother died? And remember that time my best friend died. So, you know, it's a bit heavy, and I don't want to get into a funk where that's all I'm writing. Mm-hmm. So the next novel is a departure from that, but still full of all the things that people have come to expect from me.
Oh, I really look forward to it. Thank you so much for your time, Will. Like I said, I love Sidekicks and I love the first third as well. I thought that was such incredibly great books that really talked about the human experience. So thank you for that. And I thought Sidekicks, I don't know if you read my review on Twitter, but I thought it was one of the most beautiful young adult novels I've read in a really long time. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favorite authors.